Hi, my name is Jack Lawrence, and welcome to episode 4 of my podcast. My guest today is Dr. Charlotte Waterfall. Dr. Charlotte Waterfall is an astrophysicist specializing in heliophysics and space weather. She is currently working as a postdoctoral researcher following the completion of her PhD work on flaring young stars. She is better known as space_waterfall on TikTok, where she makes educational content around her career, the latest activity from the sun, and wider astrophysics topics. In this conversation, we do a deep dive into all the topics Dr. Waterfall makes videos about. We start off with all things heliophysics, including solar flares, magnetic storms, and their associated risks for our planet. Our conversation then shifts into talking about Dr. Waterfall's academic path in physics, the culture of academia, and women in STEM. This was a super fun episode, which I think everyone can get something out of, particularly those between GCSE all the way up to first year undergrad who might be curious about a career in physics. Without further ado, here is Dr. Waterfall.
Take two stone tablets, carve. Problems are soluble. Problems are inevitable.
If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science.
Why did you do this?
That's the thousand why in this morning. There is no why. There's no why. There's no why.
Dr. Charlotte Waterfall, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. So right into it, what is heliophysics and why should we care about space weather?
Okay, well, first of all, heliophysics is the study of the sun and its effect on the solar system and the planets in it. I study heliophysics and space weather. So I'm a postdoctoral research associate. I did my undergrad in physics and then my PhD in astrophysics. And now I'm obviously a postdoc in space weather and heliophysics. So space weather is sort of similar to heliophysics. So they both kind of study how the sun affects things, but space weather is more focused on Earth and kind of the more damaging aspects of heliophysics. Which is why we really should care about it, really, because if a large solar flare or coronal mass ejection happened on the sun, we want to know and be able to predict kind of what this might do to Earth. So it can do anything from like minor disruptions to technology to, you know, massive power failures, increased radiation doses for astronauts. I mean, pretty much anything. It could have huge consequences worldwide if there was a large enough storm.
Nightmare. So there's a lot of the research then around essentially calculating a sort of existential risk or sort of like risk calculations?
Yeah, I mean, there's different kind of fields. You know, obviously with physics, you can be theoretical and observational and things like that. So I'm kind of straddling that line, I guess. So I look at, do a lot of data analysis with data from satellites and spacecraft, and then kind of use that in my models and simulations to try and kind of like compare and contrast and see, oh, this model works really well and it predicts things. And then, you know, sometimes it doesn't work very well and things like that.
Classic. I feel like most physicists have the sometimes it doesn't, often it doesn't, but the one that works, God, that works well.
I know. But yeah. The good thing about physics is even if it doesn't work, they always kind of use that as a, oh, why doesn't it work? Kind of thing. It's always a learning opportunity, I guess.
As opposed to like biology where it's like, oh, we just didn't find the samples.
Yeah.
We just got nothing. Came back with a literal empty box. But this didn't work. So that's interesting. The photos that you post on Instagram, the really awesome ones, is that from a particular which telescope's from that from? And is that the same one you use to get data for your research or?
No. So those telescopes, so the pictures I post on my Instagram are mainly from either SOHO or SDO, which is the Solar Dynamics Observatory. They're run by NASA and ESA, and they take photos of the sun in many different wavelengths, and they're all for free for educational purposes and things like that. The instruments I use, I mean, they don't take pictures for one, they're kind of particle detectors. So I use the GOES satellites. They're just satellites that NASA runs, I think ESA as well. And then eventually I might use some of the Parker Solar Probe or Solar Orbiter data or, you know, the crafts in space rather than ground-based telescopes or the ones which take the nice pictures.
Well, I don't know. So I have a question. It's probably a bit of a technical question, but I'm just really curious. So the particle detector types of things that ESA and NASA run that are in orbit, presumably those are collecting data all the time. Is there sort of raw data that you can access and then perform analysis on, or are you requesting certain calibrations What's the link between you and the thing?
Honestly, it's a bit of a minefield of trying to get data that's, you know, calibrated, background subtracted, everything like that. So one of the data sets I'm using, it's data from, I think it's between 1984 to 2017, something like that. And there's numerous papers on different methods for calibrating it and all things like that. But the issue is it's kind of a collection of different satellites' data, and each one was slightly different and slightly improved. So it's just, there are people, not me, who do that for a job and who are really good at it. So I just kind of have to wait until, you know, the specialists in that area do it, and then I can get the data. I mean, there is raw data I can use, but then, you know, it's, I don't think it's worth the referee comments being like, why haven't you background subtracted this or whatever?
It's more a headache.
Yeah. And a big kind of issue with my data as well is because I'm studying kind of large events. So these produce high energy particles, and detectors for high energy particles are very difficult to, you know, build and get into space because they need so much like shielding, really. So if there's a high energy particle that comes in, it doesn't just completely wreck the detector straight away. So there's only one or two data sources which I can actually use. So that's another kind of issue with my data there. But on the other side, so I don't use any telescopes on the ground, but I do use neutron monitor data on the ground, which are just these stations all over the world, which, you know, detect rises in the neutron counts from following a kind of large solar event. And those
didn't even know that was a thing. That's so cool. There is, yeah. We have neutron detectors around the world. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's some sort of chain reaction in the atmosphere, which, don't ask me what it is. So protons come in, something happens, and then the neutrons are picked up on the ground. So I can get that data in real time following an event, or during an event rather. So that's, and you know, there's always something else you can use.
That's pretty cool. I mean, and also speaks to the collaborative nature of physics and modern science, right? So I got a few questions around solar flares and space weather. So yeah. We mentioned at the beginning, solar flares have the sort of capability of, you know, causing sort of blackouts and sort of like electrical interference. Like, yes. How, it's funny when you say that, it's not a good thing. I would have thought, yes,
well, I mean, sometimes
they will destroy.
Thing.
Sorry. Wait, so how is it a good thing?
No, okay, sorry. Okay, I should clarify that. So obviously these events also, as well as causing, you know, disruption, they also produce things like the aurora, which are, you know, class is a good thing.
That's cool. No, for sure. I need to see those at some point. I need to make my way up.
Yeah.
Arctic Circle, Norway.
I'll just go to the top of Scotland.
You can see them there?
Yeah.
Really? Crikey. Yeah.
I actually had a comment the other day saying they're in Scotland and with their phone, they can capture them. But I will say, just kind of advertising the solar cycle. So the sun's activity kind of waxes and wanes in an 11-year cycle. So it has a minimum and a maximum. And in the maximum, it's a lot more active. You know, there's a lot more flares and the chance of seeing aurora is a lot greater. And we're currently slowly moving into a maximum. So, you know, between the years, maybe 2024 to 2026 is going to be a great time to see some aurora if anyone's planning a trip to Iceland or the Arctic Circle.
Amazing. No, that fits in perfectly with Corona definitely no longer being a thing. So this 11-year cycle presumably is to do with some sort of nuclear reaction and sort of emergent sort of structure.
Honestly, I have no idea. Don't ask
Cut that out. We'll not be invested.
It's like a big kind of, no one really knows. They sort of know, but there's not really kind of.
Oh, really? So it's just answer. They're not sure. Like, it's just.
Well, they kind of. It's all to do with the magnetic field, really. But the magnetic field is so complex in all the dynamo theory, and it's just a very intense area of solar physics that I don't really have much to do with, than knowing about the solar cycle.
Yeah. And so more intense part of the solar cycle, greater chance of activity, stronger solar flares, more numerous solar flares.
Yeah, a lot more numerous.
Right. And so in terms of like risk for a really strong one sort of being ejected towards Earth, that's the time.
Yeah. So in this solar cycle, now we're in solar cycle 25. And so the last big event was the end of October, start of November last year, so 2021. That was the biggest one we'd seen in years. So I said earlier about the neutron monitors and so the events being picked up at ground level. And when that happens, it's called a GLE, so a ground level enhancement event. And so that's really why I'm interested in these like huge events. So that was the first GLE since 2017. So wow. They're quite rare. Yeah. But they can be very disruptive. I keep using that word, but you know, it's true.
Well, you want to panic people, presumably. But is there anything we could do about it? I mean, presumably magnetic fields are going to be traveling at the same speed as light is, so we can predict them. So would we be able to let me actually ask a real question rather than just thinking out loud. If we had reason to believe that a very large solar flare was going to be jettisoned towards Earth, firstly, on what sort of notice would we possibly be able to calculate that? And secondly, is there anything we can do about it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have a lot to say on this question.
Please.
So predicting when an event is going to happen is very difficult, and it's a very open and ongoing area of physics, which is part of my job as well. So I'm funded through this huge project called SWIMMER, which aims to kind of improve the prediction and monitoring abilities of these space weather events. Predicting solar flares is very difficult, but there are certain things, you know, which we can point at and go, oh, that might be more likely. So, for example, flares happen from sunspot areas, which are kind of just tangled up regions of magnetic field. You know, the energy builds and then it's released very explosively. So we can monitor the energy of these sunspot groups and measure it. And, you know, if it's looking like it has a lot of energy, we can say, oh, there's a 50% chance of an X-class flare today or something like that. I'll just briefly say, so there's five classes of solar flare, sorry.
No, I was about to ask, so reading my mind.
So there's A, B, C, M, and X. And A's are the smallest, they happen all the time. They're not doing anything to us. Really, it's the M and the X ones, which we watch out for. So if there's an M or an X flare, you know, that there's a good chance, and if it's pointed in our direction, then there's a good chance it might hit us. I did a video on TikTok the other day about the position of the flare on the sun. So if they're towards one side of the sun, towards the western limb, then there's a good connection between the sun and the Earth, and that also increases the likelihood of a space weather event at the Earth. So there are some things. Also, CMEs, coronal mass ejections, that another thing which produce these particles. They are, okay, well, they're also hard to predict, but they also travel slower than, I mean, the radiation from a flare, it will get to us in minutes, you know, but from a CME, it will take a few days.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, it's on the matter of scale of hours compared to minutes.
Yeah.
At the very least. So, you know, those are a bit more manageable in the sense that we can monitor one and be like, uh-oh, a couple of days time, something's going to happen, prepare yourselves. But, you know, that doesn't really matter if we don't have the preparations in place anyway, which, you know, I'm not sure what there is in place, to be perfectly honest. I don't think there is as much in place as is necessary. But also, it's how much can you really afford to prepare? So to line all the satellites with like a meter of lead, like that's just,
yeah, it's just
impractical.
Yeah.
So, but also you have to have some, I don't know, what are you going to do if suddenly all the satellites go down, all the GPS goes down? No one can use their phone. Like one of my colleagues at a conference was saying about the ankle bracelets that people who've come out of prison wear, and their GPS tracked. If all of those went down, then, you know, it would be bedlam. Bedlam. Just there's like absolutely everything these days uses technology, and if it goes down, chances are very slim. I'll just say that right now.
Reemphasizing, Unlikely to happen, but...
Unlikely to happen. So we can categorize the storms, these space weather events, we call them solar storms, or geomagnetic storms, sorry. So we categorize geomagnetic storms on a grading from 1 to 5. 1 are the mildest, you know, minor disruption, very short blackouts if there are any. Up to 5, which are by far the worst. They're very rare. You get 4, on average of 4 per solar cycle. But that they would cause, I mean, they cause disruption again. But yeah, so I'll just give you a few examples. So 1989, I think it was March, there was a huge power cut in Quebec for, I think it was 9 or 10 hours, something like that. And that was because of a large geomagnetic storm from a solar flare. People love hearing about in 1967, during the Cold War, there was a large solar flare which jammed these kind of radio, what they called, like radar trackers or surveillance or something like that, which was basically
World War knowledge, but yeah.
Yeah. So they were basically surveilling or tracking, rather, if the Soviet Union released any missiles, and then suddenly they got jammed and everyone was like, oh my God, like, what's going on? Like, is there about to be a nuclear war kind of thing? And then luckily the sun kind of, not the sun, sorry, the Earth rotated out of the kind of path of all these particles coming from the sun. And luckily there was some clever solar physicists who were like, oh, actually, it's a solar flare, calm down, you know, we're not going to war. So, I mean, yeah, just a couple of examples off the top of my head.
Scary stuff. Yeah, I remember I saw a video a while back, which was talking about how, it might have been a V-source one, I'll double check, but it was about how stray particles can even hit transistors in computers and alter the ones from a zero and change a calculation, and how there's this weird someone was speed running Mario 64. This is relevant, I promise. Someone was speed running Mario 64, and it looks like they got video footage of essentially a particle hitting a chip at the right place because the character sort of jumped in a way that a glitch couldn't explain. And the best explanation is a particle. You know, which obviously must have hit off the Earth's atmosphere in some way, hit that chip at precisely the right place and alter the value.
A thing on TikTok I've also seen about solar flares and pseudoscience is when people blame their kind of like headaches and stuff on them, which really kind of grates on me.
That gives you a headache.
Yeah, it does, because also they're so passionate about it, and they just, I mean, I've never attempted to be like, what are you talking about kind of thing. You know, they're so... I mean, most of the time they're selling a product as well.
Yep.
And it's just, I don't know, it gets to me that they have such a large following and there's all these people buying into the fact that a solar flare is, you know, giving them a headache. And it's just not true. Like, if the particles were getting down to Earth every single day like this and giving you a headache every day, like, we'd know about it, you know? These neutron monitors would be pinging every day. It's just, yeah, sorry.
We'd have radiation sickness, and, you know,
yeah, 100%,
like it'd be a lot worse than just a headache. Like, you would, cancer risks, yeah, and everything, yeah.
So, you know, don't believe everything you hear on TikTok, everyone.
Yeah, so fact check. Well, it's a hard thing, right? And I was talking to Ethan, who's also on TikTok, about this, which is, there's a huge, I still get torn, because there are these people out there who are peddling pseudoscience. The thing that gets me is the putting quantum in front of everything. And
yeah, what is that?
Yeah,
I saw something about quantum jumping the other day. Like, what is that?
Oh, God. Or quantum consciousness, or quantum telepathy, or you know, quantum crystals, vibration healing. Like, I want to call it out, but it's a very aggressive thing to do. And you know, how much of it is going to work? And is the creator ultimately under the same misinformation? You know, are they doing this maliciously? Because, you know, if you did think these crystals help people, it would make sense to sort of base a business around it and try and circulate the information. So it's hard, but yeah, I also just, you know, look at my phone and seethe. I don't hate follow, though. I definitely don't hate follow.
No. That's surely not a thing. They surely just must actually like us, and they're just trolling, and I don't know.
It's cognitive dissonance. Yeah, I follow them just to see, you know, what the wrong scientists are saying. Yeah. You know, you love us. So I got that clear. So you've got the ABC, MNX types of class of flare, and then you got the 1 to 5 solar storm, geomagnetic storm. And are those correlated in any way? So would a geomagnetic storm be caused by a solar flare, or are those?
So any kind of solar eruptive event. I tend to use the word solar eruptive event because it encompasses solar flares and coronal mass ejections kind of under one umbrella. But yeah, any large flare or large or fast coronal mass ejection is, there's definitely a correlation, very strong correlation between that happening and a large geomagnetic storm at Earth. Obviously, some of them aren't always pointed in the right direction. So there's that. But, you know, generally, we want to be on the lookout for these large flares.
Gotcha. And as, yeah, and as you were saying, as a society, with our increasing technology, we're becoming more and more really vulnerable to these things. Whereas if we didn't have so much technology, I imagine in the 90s, if a class X hit us, or we had a sort of level 5 magnetic storm, it would mean less disruption versus nowadays, which is an interesting thing about, I guess.
Yes. Well, okay, something that I often get asked about on TikTok, but I haven't actually made a video about yet, is the Carrington event. I don't know if you've heard
of it. Do not know the Carrington event, no.
So there's this very well-known event in solar physics called the Carrington event. Happened in 1859, and it was basically, well, we think it was a huge solar flare, basically. And obviously there wasn't much technology around at that period in time, but there was aurora seen around the Caribbean, and the telegraph poles or wires, whatever it is, were fried that did exist. So that was a seriously damaging event in 1859. So if there was something on a similar scale now, I mean, I don't even know what would happen. You can't even comprehend like the chaos that would ensue if all the technology just went out.
The amount of energy we could absorb as well, I think, you know, because obviously a magnetic field, a lot of energy happens when there's a change in flux. And so basically, to the people who don't necessarily know electromagnetism, because we've basically got wires laid down everywhere now for electricity grids and everything, we've basically just built, if you wanted to build something to absorb the energy and cook from a solar flare, we're doing that basically now. I think that's fair to say, wouldn't you?
So when people ask me like, oh, is there a chance like these kind of events could happen? I mean, yes, absolutely. They are incredibly rare. And we're currently working on better and better models. There are already models that forecast and kind of predict these things. Really, like, we don't know the scale of the devastation that this could cause. And we don't know how much an event is going to affect us. So the largest flare that ever occurred, for example, was an X-class flare. It was an X28 flare. So the bands range from 1 to 10. So you have M1 to M10 and then X1 upwards. But this was an X28.
Wow,
it was
okay.
very powerful. Didn't do anything to Earth. Didn't touch us. You can't say every event is going to damage us.
Yeah. We've also got other stuff to worry about, like Yellowstone and tsunamis and earthquakes.
I know. Yeah. Everything is going to destroy us.
It's a fun planet to live on. We're doing all right, all things considered. It's a hostile universe out there, people. Stay safe. So I feel like you're choosing your words very carefully around, you know, like, it, obviously stressing this is unlikely. And the way science is conveyed in the media is often frustrating just because, I mean, a lack of understanding of sort of nuanced statistics, or even not that nuanced statistics around, you know, what probability really means. Does it sort of frustrate you how science is conveyed in the media today? Is there an aspect of it that particularly annoys you? Or, yeah.
From like a physics and astronomy point of view?
From a physics and astronomy, from any point of view. It's an open-ended question.
I mean, I'll stick to, you know, what I know. Yes and no. You kind of have these sensationalized headlines like, oh, giant solar flare going to destroy Earth and comet.
Ironically printed in the Sun.
exactly. And then you have these headlines about the comets that are going to come within X distance of Earth and destroy Earth and blah, 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 blah. And if you read the article, and if the article is well written and, you know, quotes these peer-reviewed sources, it will become clear that, you know, this isn't realistically going to happen. But I get, so it doesn't really frustrate me, why they're writing these articles like this. You know, they need to get people in. If you just write an article like, oh, this might happen, like, but it's not a very good chance. No one's going to read it.
Yeah.
And, you know, science needs all the publicity it can get, really.
That's for sure. Yeah. And someone might be frightened into studying solar flares.
Yeah.
Why is no one doing anything about this? You know.
Yeah. I can't remember the exact article, but so anytime some scientists discover sort of elements in another planet or moon's atmosphere that we have on Earth, they're like, oh, might be life on a different planet. And like, those are the kind of headlines where, you know, they're designed to get people in. But if you actually read it, it's just kind of like, oh, we found a molecule like that we have on Earth, you know?
Yeah. Big whoop. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, like, as long as people are reading it, then you know, it doesn't bother me too much.
Also, the tendency for articles to be written around journals that don't peer review, where, you know, anyone can just submit anything. That's also, it's like, article. Yeah, that's like,
really, this word gets my goat.
Gets your goat. Yeah. You can swear if you want. I don't know. I haven't sweared on this podcast yet.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. You're going to beat me out.
I'll work it out. That's for me in post. That's a me problem, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, okay. So anyone, anecdotally, anyone I know who got into astrophysics, astronomy, anything like that, were given like a big picture book as a kid, or like were reading to space films. Is that your story or is it not?
I mean, yes and no. Okay, so I've always been into space, like since I can remember, but I don't have kind of one single memory that I can pinpoint as that was the point where I got into space kind of thing. I always kind of like to tell the story that when I was like 3 or 4 days old, the first place I ever went was Jodrell Bank, which is a large radio telescope in Manchester.
Oh, wow. And,
yeah, I like to say that, you know, it kind of like subconsciously as a baby, I was like...
You were on it. Most people just can't see for like several days. You're like, this is a telescope.
Yeah. But just going back to what you said about the picture book, I do remember when I was younger, I had this kind of very... Obviously, it was made for children. I think it was by Sir Patrick Moore. It was just a picture book full of planets called The Planets. It still had Pluto in. And I just vividly remember always looking through that and thinking, wow, this is so cool.
Classic rookie era about the Pluto being a planet thing. Do you agree with the mainstream? It obviously shouldn't be a planet. You have no...
Man, people are very passionate about this on TikTok.
Yeah.
Very passionate. I mean, honestly, it doesn't really bother me. I'm not one of those kind of... massive Pluto activists out there.
It's always interesting what hills people will be willing to die on, and for that lone planet, not planet rather, oh god, Freudian slip, rock out in the outermost bits of the solar system.
I mean, it's a dwarf planet, that should be enough for people.
It got downgraded. Okay, so you very briefly went over your background and what sort of led you into your PhD, but like in a bit more detail.
I also get a lot of questions about this, but obviously it's very different in the UK and the US and everywhere else, so I always kind of very strictly say this is my opinion and my experience, and it varies quite a lot, especially in physics. So for A-level I did further maths, physics and biology, so I did those AS and A-level. AS, I mean, I actually struggled with physics quite a lot. I got a C in my first physics AS, which devastated me.
Oh
yeah,
my God.
It was awful. It was one of those multiple choice exams, I guess. I always hated them. And there wasn't any astro in it. And it was just all the stuff I didn't like in physics. That was a bad day.
But, so did you double down off the back of that? You were like, no, I'm going to be a literal physicist to get revenge.
Yeah. Well, I always knew I wanted to do space and go into astrophysics. So I was just like, look, it's just a blip. Like everything else, I got an A in, and, you know, it's just one of those things. So I just retook it, got an A. It was fine. You know, forget about
it. In the past.
On.
Got it.
Yeah. So that was that. And then I got all A's at A level, but I got an A star in maths, which I think it was either the first or the second year the A stars were a thing in A levels. So it was one of my requirements to get into the physics course at uni.
Amazing.
So I went to Lancaster, and I was originally meant to do physics with astrophysics as the degree title, but I ended up on a degree scheme where I studied abroad in America. So actual title was just physics. So yeah.
Where do you study in America?
Illinois in Urbana-Champaign.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, it was good. Yeah, I was there in third year. It was I turned 20 like the day I got there. So it was very strange going from, you know, 2 years of uni in England where, you know, you can do whatever you want. And then
you're an adult.
It's very different. I wasn't expecting the culture shock of studying there. Like, I've been to America before on holiday and I was like, yeah, I love America. And then studying there was just completely different. It was just the work ethic the students have there or have to have there because they're all competing with themselves. It's just ridiculous. It's so competitive.
So I actually don't know about this. So in what way do they, when you say competing with themselves,
So they grade more on the curve there. So
oh, crikey. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're all fighting for an A, but only so many of you can get it. And it might be 90% for an A. Whereas in England, it's like, if you get over 70%, like, you're good, you got a first. So
yeah, yeah. For those that may not know, so pretty much exactly as you said, but I think some unis do it whereby it's as a justification to make sure that the degree is worth the same year on year, that they want to say, we want to give a certain amount, like a 20% of people first, otherwise the exams are getting easier or harder. And say that 1 year, someone writes an exam, a maths exam or a physics exam, which is disproportionately easy or disproportionately hard, and say that, you know, actually the highest mark 1 year is 70%. It's like, well, you can't really fail an entire year to accommodate for that. That's why that's the justification generally for grading on a curve, but it does lead to this incessant, horrible competitiveness. Was there any sabotage? Were they not that bad?
No, I wouldn't say so. It was all very competitive, but there was lots of study groups and things like that. And you all kind of work together on the worksheets and coursework and things like that. Like, generally it was fine. There was just more of a, you could feel the stress more in the American students about having to get this grade point average up and being on the honor roll and things like that. It was just very, But I mean,
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I just wanted to clarify that even though kind of the grade boundaries may seem very disproportionate, the actual level of studying is exactly the same. It's not like one country is harder or easier. You know, if you have a physics degree, you're not being taught any other easier physics.
Exactly. No, this is what I always try and say. It's like the laws of physics don't get more difficult from uni to uni. Hopefully not. So.
No, I feel like people get really hung up on kind of the standard of the uni they're going to and things like that. And generally, it shouldn't matter too much, you know.
And also, so Manchester's just amazing for physics, like one of the best. I say that, which is ironic given what you've just said. But I think from a research perspective, like reputationally, there's one thing about what you're taught at undergrad. But generally, I think if you want to become an academic, that's where prestige.
Yeah, for sure.
Generally care more about it, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, it's a great thing to kind of have on your CV, the name of a good research uni, especially if you have a good supervisor. So I did my undergrad and my master's at Lancaster and then moved to Manchester for my PhD. And it was great. I mean, I really liked being at Manchester for my PhD. It was, it's a large department, a lot larger than the one I'm in at the moment. There is a kind of level of expectation, I feel like, when I was at Manchester, like, they obviously want you to be your best, like they do at any uni, but just because the research groups were so large and varied, so there was cosmology and kind of time domains of pulsars and things like that and solar physics, and it was just very varied, very good research department.
And Brian Cox just walking around.
So I was in the astrophysics department, and the physics department was a separate building. But you could go and like walk past this office and stuff.
Right. So you made
TikToks. Want me to go back to my PhD?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Go back to your PhD. You're right. So
my PhD was obviously in astrophysics. It was kind of cross-discipline. So it was a mix of solar physics and star formation. So the title of my PhD was Modeling the Variable Radio Emission in Young Stellar Flares.
That's awesome.
Which I'll explain very quickly. So obviously you have a flare, whether it's on the sun or another star, it's the sudden release of a large amount of energy and radiation, sort of kind of a large explosion, basically. It's detectable in a lot of different wavelengths, radio and X-ray are the main ones, which I was looking at. And you can basically use these to follow the activity and, you know, find out more about star formation and things like that. So that's it in a nutshell. And then I've obviously moved on to more solar physics and heliophysics since then.
So anyone I ever speak to who's done a PhD has found it very hard at times, And in the first year, at least, they were panicking and didn't think they'd really gotten anything done. And then by the end, it was a bit of a sort of like panic write-up where they went, oh, actually, I have done a lot over these years. Was that generally reflective of your experience, or were you just cruising?
I think it was like panic all the way through.
Okay, cool. Great.
I mean, I'd say maybe second year was my like panic year, because it was kind of the first year I was publishing and things like that. And it was just learning a lot of different things very quickly about more of the academic side of things. But I was funded for 3.5 years, and it was technically meant to work in the way that you research for 3 years and spend that last 0.5 years writing up your thesis. But in reality, I think I'd spent like the last 3 writing up, something like that. But yeah, it was good.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Hopefully that's the hard stuff out of the way then.
I'm kind of doing the same stuff. I'm just still doing research, but there was just felt way more pressure on, you know, writing a thesis and having the exam on it and everything like that.
So. And as you say, also learning the culture of academia and the pressure to publish, I'm sure was sort of a new thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'll talk more about publishing and peer review later on. I'm sure it's not my favorite area of academia. Or research, that's for sure.
So. Cool. Okay. Well, before we dive into that then, let's talk about TikTok. Because yes. Obviously that's you know, how I know you. Obviously, I feel like you're using the platform for pretty much the same reasons I am, which is just education and sort of like, you know, trying to encourage people to sort of be interested in investing in your subject. Was this a decision? Have you done educational content before? Like, why do you start to do this? Was it just on a whim?
Okay, so in kind of research, well, throughout my PhD and my postdoc, kind of they've always pushed you to, or encouraged you, I should say, to engage in outreach and, you know, communicating with the wider audience, and especially people who aren't necessarily in the industry, about your work and science and things like that. I did a bit of it during my PhD. So I worked at things like Blue Dot Festival, which is a huge science and music festival.
I should know it, but I don't. I'm a hermit, sorry.
It's been postponed the last couple of years. It's held in Manchester underneath Jodrell Bank.
Okay, fair enough.
So, so stuff like that. And then I started my postdoc, but I started it in lockdown. So there's pretty much zero outreach opportunities apart from kind of the odd Zoom talk with a school or something like that.
And those are painful. I just Zoom talks, like just Zoom anything nowadays, especially after all the time we spent locked down. It's just horrific. So
it's not my favorite. And like, I don't massively enjoy public speaking anyway. So I was like, well, I'm on TikTok, I might as well make some TikTok videos. Like, it kind of ticks the outreach box.
No, definitely, definitely, 100%.
Yeah, and then ticks, you know, the getting used to public speaking, I guess, and answering the questions and making the videos does help my work as well, because, you know, my work is very related to my TikToks. You know, not a lot of TikTok accounts are like that, I guess.
Yeah, not mine. that's for sure. Yeah, I can't claim that. But also same. The videos I made were things that I had written about and done my, you know, thesis on and all that. But having to make videos about them and re-explain them and, you know, see how much I can condense and all that has strengthened my understanding. I had a better understanding of relativity after I made videos about them, just because I had to go through everything again. I went, oh yeah, this is a great way of explaining it. So
yeah, especially when someone asks me something about some concept I haven't done since like second year or something like that. It's like, okay, let me go away for half an hour and research it. I'll get back to you. But, you know, I'm going to have to relearn this.
It's a good excuse. And I think we forget that, or at least for a lot of the physicists I know, you know, we learned all this theory in undergrad, you know, at a master's level, and we were basically just calculation machines and we knew everything. And then, you know, you specialize for about 4 or 5 years on a PhD and then become a postdoc, and you don't need to use all those electromagnetic equations. And so you look at them and you go, well, I could do this a while ago. But
I know. I don't think I use, I mean, rough estimate, maybe 80% of what I did in my degree, 70%. You do need it all. Like, you never know. I mean, obviously, I knew I wanted to go into space, but people who do a physics degree, I feel like most of the people I know who did them don't necessarily know what they want to do in 5 years or immediately after their degree. So it is useful to broadly study several areas of physics.
Definitely. And you know, the great thing about physics is hopefully it all links together. So, you know, if you do end up, you know, with a particular question, or, I mean, well, even if you're not using you know, Maxwell's equations. The sun creates magnetic fields, so you need to have at least a sort of certain understanding of that concept, even if you're not ever going to be using sort of, you know, div, grad or whatever, stuff like that. Not to bring that up. I don't want to go through that again. That was a dark time, dude. That was a dark time. So the 80% of your degree that you use thing, it reminds me of when I was doing my finals for undergrad. I think me and a friend sat down, we calculated that it was literally about 1 to 0.5% of everything we'd ever been taught was the thing that was going to decide our end of year grade. It was just like, oh, that's frightening in a sense of, and it was just these sort of niche mixture of, you know, thermodynamics, nuclear stuff, and just, yeah.
Yeah. Did you have to do like a general physics exam?
Yeah.
So we had to do stuff that like encompassed like first 3 years of our degree, basically.
So I sort of managed to sidestep that partially because I'm a wuss. So the way it worked for natural sciences was first year you had to pick 4 modules. One was had to be a mathematics, and then you had to pick 3 sciences. So I did physics, materials, and earth sciences. Was not into rocks. Let's not get into that. I was not good at identifying rocks, but that's fine. We moved past that. We got to second year where we could just do maths, physics A and physics B. And so that we had some, it, like the physics A exam and physics B exams were like broad across multiple topics. Third year, we had topic specific stuff. So on like nuclear thermodynamics, I think sometimes they overlapped. But if you did the fourth year, which I didn't do, the hard exam for master's physics at Cambridge is called the general paper. And the sort of rule of that paper is they can ask you on anything they've taught you in the entire 4 years. So you might get a special relativity question on calculated time dilation. So yeah, it's really, you have to learn, like anything you've learned could come up. So I didn't do that because I didn't do the master's. I did my master's at Oxford in the philosophy of physics. That was the hardcore general paper, which I didn't do. Heroically avoided.
It's a tough one. I can't even remember. I think I got 2-1 in that. I can't remember. Yeah. I pretty much resigned myself to not doing well in that paper. So yeah.
Well, 2-1's pretty good for if that was your...
I was aiming for first in my final year. I mean, I only had to get a 2-1 to get my PhD, to do my PhD, sorry. But I think most unis want a first to get onto the PhD scheme.
Yeah, I know I'd sort of written that off, but this isn't about me. So at least I could make it about me, but I won't. So TikTok videos, obviously, you make them for a little bit. What's most surprised you about making these videos? Has there been a particular type? You said sometimes you get a question which reminds you of a topic that you haven't looked at for a while, but are there any comments that you can't believe people think a certain way? Or what have your impressions been?
I could go on about
please,
this tonight.
Please.
Yeah.
Most of them
are quite negative, but I'll start with a positive one. So I am generally surprised by the amount of support that people give me on TikTok. You know, with social media, it's kind of well known for being quite a nasty environment. Yeah. And especially with something like physics, if people who are interested in science are watching your videos, there is a bit of a stereotype of them kind of pointing out what's wrong and being extra pedantic and things like that. But generally, like 90% of the stuff is very positive, very encouraging. And it's made me continue making the videos, to be honest. So that's, I mean, the first positive point.
That's the good stuff.
Yeah. So the comments about flat earthers and things like that. Yeah. Well, this is the thing, right? So every time I get a comment like that, I'll click on the profile and see who's posted it.
Who is this? Yeah.
Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, they're following me. So why are they following me if they believe the earth is flat? Are they just winding me up? Am I supposed to be in on this joke? Like, surely. Or do they actually think the earth is flat?
Yeah. I don't know what the ratio of like troll to legit believer is. I'd be really curious. I would hope it's like 9 to 1. I was one person I interviewed a couple of episodes ago, Dr. Helena Bates, who does planetary sciences, and she the way she phrased it was really interesting because she was referencing a documentary, and she said, and she was very careful how she said this, she said flat earthers in a way are kind of scientific, in that, you know, they're running experiments, they have a theory of the world, they collect evidence, and they're sort of making arguments. Yeah. They're wrong, but you know, they're really sort of like trying to parse out the world, you know, albeit you know, they're missing something fundamental. And I thought that was like quite a generous, if even compassionate interpretation of what a lot of flat earthers are. I feel like that's the main thing that's gonna get you, right? Because the sun, I don't know of any controversies or conspiracies around the sun.
I obviously I don't make a point of researching flat earth theories and things like that, but I've only ever seen flat earth. I've never seen flat sun or flat
the flat sun
moon theory. Or I mean, maybe they just haven't thought about it yet, but you never know. But anyway, that's something I get reasonably often, I'd say. I found that I get a lot more kind of I don't really want to call them hate comments, kind of comments which I disagree with. I get the most of those on my videos which aren't really as sciencey. So I try and kind of balance, because I'm on TikTok, I try and balance my science ones with more kind of like the fun kind of trending ones, I guess. With a science edge in some way. And I get the most hate comments on those ones. Like any comment where I say my age or that I have a PhD, it'll be like, go back to school or something kind of
a really
bit, you know. Yeah, those ones really wind me up.
Yeah, I bet, because I don't have a PhD and no one tells me that. That's very unfair.
I mean, I have a what's the word, like a mantra, I guess, or a motto of don't reply to any kind of negative comment, because I mean, they frustrate me anyway, but I don't want to spend any more time getting frustrated writing a comment and then getting another negative reply. And most of the time someone who follows me will kind of do the replies for me, and I'll see it doesn't get them anywhere, so
yes,
you know, I've saved that time.
The space waterfall community coming in. Coming in hot.
There are some passionate debates in those comments, but also, you know, the comments raise my engagement. So
no, absolutely no, I feel the same way. Like I was going to say, my experience pretty much mirror yours. Most are supportive, even if I get, it varies on the science. It's pretty much the same, where I'd say I get 90% really positive, like, you know, didn't know this, all that. 10% quite snarky, you know, this is nonsense. You know, sometimes anti-Semitic stuff if it's about Einstein or whatever. It's a bit worrying. Yeah, that was quite unexpected. But on the philosophy ones, because obviously it's a lot more, you know, it's not like this is the case, this person thought it was the case.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm always very careful to be like, this person said this. I'm not saying this. This is a thing that a person has said. And there are still intense debates where they say, oh, you're wrong. Like, no,
I imagine you get a lot, because obviously I found, like, as I get more followers, that those numbers of comments increase. So you must be fielding them a lot more than I am right now.
I sort of tune out. I think the way to sanity on TikTok is to, I pay attention for the first couple of hours. And then I'll check in every so often. But other than that, the first two hours is more, you know, has someone seen a mistake that's really obvious that I've myself have failed to detect? Because the thing I'm most frightened about is putting out something that's inaccurate. But if they don't like it, but it's true, that's fine. That's, you know, is what it is.
Yeah. I particularly don't like the ones where, I mean, TikTok, for anyone who doesn't know, TikTok, the maximum video length is 3 minutes. But most people make, you know, 20-second videos.
Yeah, most sane people. Yeah, that's what you're meant to do. I really need to learn how to do that. I'm like, it'll be a like, bitch, I record and it's like 15 minutes. I'm like, I'm so stupid.
Do you record and then, because I just record on the TikTok app, because I can never be bothered to, you know, kind of do a separate editing and
I'm too scared. My front-facing camera on my phone is terrible, for one. I just look like a pale pixel, and so it's partially just vanity. I'm like, no, I need to use a proper camera for this, obviously. Clearly it's going to be a better video. So I edit it separately because I'm just, I don't know, perfectionist, insert insecurity here. So
well, maybe I should start doing it. It's a high production value, I guess. So,
well, the way I justify it beyond the vanity is, if you're gonna make something, why not make it look good? You know, I think it's the YouTube channel Every Frame a Painting, and it was just a video on cinematography, And someone just made the point of like, well, if you can make something look interesting, why wouldn't you? And I was like, oh, that's kind of a good point. So I can try and bear that in mind, whether it's, but then, you know, there are people who use their front facing camera, turn it on for 15 seconds and get, you know, 10 million views every video. So, you know, the joke very much may be on me. I'm not saying this is the path to success.
Sorry, I went on a massive tangent then. I was just going to say,
it was great
about the shortness of videos.
Yeah.
So obviously you can't, especially in science, you can't include everything in a 20-second video. And then you get the comments like, oh, but you forgot this and you forgot that. And what about this? And it's like, well, I'm not here to give you a full education on this one topic. You know, I'm here to just give you a stupid TikTok video introduction to it.
Yeah.
And if you want, you can, here are some resources where you can go and read about it yourself. And sorry, I didn't include that one random mathematical equation on it, but you know, that's not what the people want to see.
That's not what the people want. I think we definitely, these are the 1%, 0.1% of commenters that say this. I think most people, but yeah, they stick with you. It's weird, isn't it? These negative things. You're just like, ah, oh, criticism.
Another theme to some of the more negative comments, which I was definitely expecting, is the whole women in physics.
That's exactly what I was about to ask about. Yeah.
Because I also use a lot of the hashtags, you know, women in STEM, blah, 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 those kind of things. So they, you know, get people to mention it anyway. But I was expecting it, but it doesn't make it any less annoying when I see people say things like, there's been women in STEM for decades. What are you moaning about? Blah, blah, blah. Like, first of all, I'm not moaning. I'm literally just making a video as a woman in STEM. And secondly, like, there have been women in STEM for decades, but that doesn't mean there's any sort of equality, like, in STEM for women, especially physics. I think physics is one of the worst sciences for it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. During my undergrad, even first year, the ratio of men to women was definitely not good. Have the TikTok comments that you've experienced on your videos that do relate to being a woman in STEM, do those echo the sorts of things you heard as you sort of achieved a career in STEM? So, you know, going through undergrad, and is it different compared to within the physics community versus outside of it? Just asking for your anecdotal experience, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's definitely, it's a lot more negative on TikTok and social media and outside the physics community. There have sort of been times where people will make subtle comments that I might not necessarily pick up on. So if I don't know, said I wanted to go and do this thing, it'd be like, oh, that's, you know, that's all men doing that kind of thing. You sure you want to do that? Like, you know,
okay.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And it's never put me off, but it's just, I don't know, it's made me very aware that there is still a very large issue of kind of the gender imbalance, and massively so kind of the representation of minority groups in physics is awful, like absolutely awful. I mean, I don't feel like you know, obviously I'm a white woman, I'm come from a pretty good background, you know, I'm immediately, you know, have a higher privilege than a lot of people wanting to get into physics. I went to an all-girls private school where they were actively encouraging, you know, do like academic subjects like maths and science and all that. So, I mean, I already had that going for me when I was a teenager, like a lot of people don't. And also, just while I'm talking about school, I was looking at kind of the staff pages on university websites and seeing just how many female to male staff they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the worst universities was maybe like 11% females to males. And then,
was that across the entire university or just the department?
Just the physics department.
Just the physics department.
Yeah. And then I think the average was kind of like 25 to 30%, which is what Google says. It's about a third female. And it's kind of annoyed me. And I thought it was really bad because I thought in my head, even though I'm in it and I'm experiencing it, I thought it was better. But then I was thinking about why this is kind of thing. And I do think such a large issue is schools. And there's just so few people getting interested in physics in school. Like, I've had comments on my TikTok about, oh, I hate GCSE physics and things like that. And if it's anything like when I did GCSE physics, I didn't like it either. Like, it was all circuits and they didn't.
No one likes circuits. Literally no one likes circuits. I've never met anyone. It's like, yeah, circuit question. This is great.
It's awful. Well, I mean, I think it's awful. But
no, it's okay. If there's anyone out there who likes circuits, I'm not judging you. It's fine. But
yeah, no. Sorry. Whatever. But I am, I don't know. It's just you get given these equations or like, oh, you're on a hill. What's the potential energy of being on the hill? Or some like stupid question like that.
With gravity, and yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, why? How is anyone ever going to get interested in physics from a question like that? Like, there is a big problem with teenagers and kids because not being interested in physics. I mean, I think it's more easy to get people interested in space because, you know, space is very cool.
Space is very cool.
Yeah, but physics, I think it's a bit harder. But that's just my opinion.
I detoured
from the women in STEM there.
Well, my question was going to be following that. Do you think you mentioned a lack of sort of female representation, which I think is probably also like massive, and that's obviously a vicious cycle that occurs. And obviously, the sort of essentially the stereotype of a physicist is an old white man, which is not helpful. For sure. Do you think any other factors that sort of play into it?
Yeah, I mean, sorry, just briefly going touching on what you just said about kind of influences. Like the old white man. But there's obviously like Stephen Hawking, Brian Cox, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, Bill Nye, the science guy, they're all men. Like there aren't really any, I think, alive large female influences in physics and astronomy. I mean, I know a lot of TikTokers and YouTubers who have, you know, large followings, but they're not anywhere near kind of the mainstream of someone like Brian Cox. So I do feel like that could have, that could play a large role in getting more women interested. So there was that recent call for astronauts from the European Space Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if they can get more women through that, I think there was already a large increase in the number of women applications they had. But I think that will do wonders for physics and astronomy, having, especially if someone in the UK, obviously.
Yeah. Go UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's definitely a problem that, you know, we'd like to see addressed, and it's also frustrating because all the academics and staff are always going to be a lagging measure of whatever's done at the schools at this stage, so it's just going to take time. As a woman in STEM, would you have any advice to someone who's a woman who's currently perhaps in her teens thinking about pursuing a career in physics or STEM? Would you have any advice for someone in that position?
Yeah, I mean, let me think about it.
That's cool. I'll think about how to phrase that question better as well.
No, it was good. I just have a lot of like answers running through my head. So when I was first starting out, kind of late school age, early uni age, obviously I was in a very kind of male dominated class at uni, and I was always, you know, very scared to voice an opinion or ask a question. And I do feel like, I hate to say it, but I do feel like it's a common like trait among women to, you know, they sometimes feel like they can't speak up in an environment where there's a lot of men around. So I'd always, you know, be a bit afraid to ask, and definitely afraid to ask in case it was wrong and, you know, I was laughed at or something like that. But it's hard to say, the sooner you can get over that, the better. But in science and physics, the more discussion and debate you can bring out, the better you're going to be in science, because it's all about asking questions like, why does this happen? What is this doing? Like, what can possibly be causing that? And even if all you can come up with is kind of like stupid or really basic answers, you know, they lead on to other points. Like, it's just never be afraid to, you know, talk out loud and discuss your opinions and thoughts with someone. So that's kind of like the first bit of advice. The second one is, I guess this is a bit more general for kind of grad school and things like that, but, you know, do your research on where you want to study and who you want to study with. So I'm obviously very specialized in space weather and heliophysics and stuff like that. Not every uni in the UK does that. A very small number does it. So, like, say, for example, I can't think of it. Okay, well, let's just say, so not every uni in the UK does it. So I don't want to be limited by, you know, so like looking at a league table or something like that and being like, well, I can't go here and do what I actually want to do because it's not a good uni. It's not in the top five or whatever. You know, I think for things like research and your PhD even, you know, do your research of what you actually want to do. Find an academic who you want to study under and who you want to be supervised by. And that is far more important than the ranking of the uni in a table. I mean, obviously there's things like research tables, which take into account the research quality that the university does. But definitely take those with a pinch of salt, you know. Just if it's a smaller uni, it might be doing great research, but it might not have, you know, the breadth of research and the number of great academics to get themselves high on those tables. So, I mean, there's that. Sorry, that was kind of a garbled answer.
No, that's fantastic. I think it would also, you agree that on that last point, that what really matters in a lot of these cases is just your relationship with your supervisor. And
yeah, you know, 100%. Like you could go to a prestigious uni. If you get a rubbish supervisor for your PhD or your master's project, then you're going to be, it's going to be so much harder for you to get your degree, whatever it is, to write your thesis. Like, yeah, I just can't stress that enough. A good supervisor goes so much further than anything else in something like a PhD. Yeah, I just want to add one more thing to the advice for kind of women in physics or people who are interested. You know, there are a lot of resources out there. There's grants, there's scholarships for specifically for women or minority groups in physics. So, you know, do your research about them. There's societies in university. You know, there's a lot of resources out there. You know, there is the imbalance, but it's not to say that people aren't trying to, you know, make it better.
So if you want it, go for it, basically.
Yeah, basically. You know, find something you like doing and go for it.
Did you have any particular academic mentors or a particular influential teacher in school that like stand out?
So interestingly, also kind of related to the women in STEM, not by design, I have had a string of female mentors and supervisors. So in school, I had two physics teachers, both great, both loved both of them. One of them was a woman. And then I did my master's project. My master's supervisor was a man. He was great. Loved him as well. And then
on record.
And then my PhD, I had two supervisors because I had that kind of cross-discipline thing. One was a woman, one was a man. They were both great again, but I don't know. I think I spent more time with my female supervisor, and I think she was just like she was just a great PhD supervisor. Like, I can't say enough good things about her. Very encouraging. You know, I mentioned earlier about there's kind of not a lot of praise in academia and things like that. She was always, you know, telling me when I'd done something good and well, and encouraging me to go to these conferences and present my work and, you know, network and meet these people. And then my supervisor now is a woman as well, and she's great as well. She's exactly the same. So I think they've all been, even like every single one of them, I've just lucked out, I think, and had great supervisors all the way along. So
yeah, good management. It's just such an important skill. In anything. That's awesome. That's really great. Swinging back to heliophysics, is there generally at the frontier of any subject, debates become more and more niche, and there are discussions. Is there a hot debate? Oh, that's a terrible pun. I'm going to keep that in. Is there a debate that's highly contested within heliophysics, or anything? What are discussions like?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I can think of a few. So probably the one which causes the most contention and is causing contention at the moment for me with a paper I've got under review is, so when the sun kind of emits these high energy particles that travel towards the Earth and cause loads of disruption, they're accelerated by something in the sun. So either a solar flare or a shock from a coronal mass ejection. And there are a lot of people very passionately saying they're accelerated from the shock from the coronal mass ejection. And then there's a bunch of people saying, no, it's the flare. So yeah, it's just, and trying to, I mean, I don't fall on either side.
I was going to say, you team shock or team flare?
Okay. I'm very open to
very diplomatic.
I know. Well, I mean, I just don't think there's enough convincing evidence, especially in something like physics, to say this is definitively the answer. This is the only thing causing these things. Like, it's so complex, that environment. You just, in my opinion, anyway, you can't. But also from that perspective, it's hard to argue in a peer review report when someone's like, "Why have you said this? Like, this is, it's not what I think. Like, you should be saying this so this supports my ideas," kind of thing. It's yeah, so that's definitely one of the, I mean, something obviously on my mind this week. Yeah. As I,
if it's on your mind, it might be a good time to swing into your thoughts about academia and sort of peer review, mm-hmm. In general. So is that you get three people reviewing your paper and you get comments back from them, reviewer one, reviewer two, reviewer three? Or,
well, in my experience, I've only ever had one reviewer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think it depends on the journal. So you have, right. In my experience, I've published in a few different journals, or like me and my co-authors have. And so you have the editor and then you have the reviewer. And if you have an issue with the reviewer, like a really big issue, then you can go to the editor and they'll kind of judge it as to who's in the right, kind of thing. But yeah, it's, for me, it's one of the most negative parts of being a researcher is the peer review process. Like, you pour this, like, all this effort into these months of work to do this, to produce this paper, which has all of these findings and results in, which, I mean, you wouldn't publish it unless you believed in it and backed it. And then you get these like pages of comments back being like, this is wrong. Why have you done this? You need to include this. And it's just demoralizing when there's no kind of positive comments at all about it. And I know some people are like, well, why do you need praise? Like, you know, just get on with it, kind of thing. But I think especially when a lot of the people who are lead authors on these paper are students, and if that's your first experience of academia and research, and it's just someone just flagging off your paper, then it's so gutting to read.
Especially when so much of academia and just getting to that position, you have to weather so much stuff. And so you think, yeah, finally I'm going to be getting some interactions with an actual scientist who's doing the job that I want. And yeah. Your only experience of that is just be better.
I know.
This is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if you have like, I mean, well, most people have imposter syndrome in any job, but in physics...
Nah, I'm great at mine, dude. I'm sick, but no, go on. Sorry.
If you're like a PhD student who is going to be stressed, like, I think, was it a half or a third of PhD students have some sort of a trouble with their mental health at some point in their degree.
Yeah, that's a very sobering statistic, which, yeah, for those wanting to do a PhD, all the jokes about depression, they're jokes because they're funny because they're true jokes. Like, take this seriously.
I mean, yeah, it's not great, but it's a very demanding job. It is worth it when you get that PhD, but anyway, yeah.
Sorry, you were saying, I cut off with a silly joke.
Just, it's fine. So if you're a student who's, you know, suffering and there's stress with all this work, and then you finally submit this paper and you're wondering if you're actually good at physics, and you have this like suffocating imposter syndrome, and you get it back and it's just, this is rubbish. Why are you publishing this? I mean, obviously they wouldn't say that, but it's demoralizing. And so the peer review process, you either get the paper straight accepted, or you get minor or major modifications, or just kind of rejected. Typically you get minor or major modifications. No one really gets a paper accepted just straight off the bat. And you only really get it rejected if you kind of go through a couple of rounds of negotiations, I guess, with the referee. So it to have to kind of go through it multiple times to get your paper published as well, it is a draining process, and it does make you question your work sometimes. But it does teach you to, you know, debate and, you know, get your point across even more forcefully, and it does improve the papers, you know, like 95% of the time. So I mean, I'm an advocate for peer review process. I'm just saying, you know, it's a tough part of the job.
It could be nicer, I think. I think you can still have the constructive criticism while it being more encouraging. Presumably. I don't see why those two would necessarily be at odds with one another.
Part of me wonders if there's a bit of the stereotype of physicists coming into play there as well, because they just kind of say stuff very bluntly. Especially in kind of conferences, if you give a presentation, they'll just kind of speak their mind about your work and your presentation. Instead of asking, you know, a constructive question, they'll just be like, oh, this is wrong. Why have you done this? It's the same thing. And I know a lot of physicists who are like that, unfortunately.
Just generally hostile.
Yeah, just kind of, yeah. I mean, they're very intelligent. They're very smart and they're very good at the job. But they're very blunt with how they approach you sometimes.
Mm. Yeah, we need more cuddly physicists, maybe. Just nicer kindness training for the physicists.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, as I'm speaking as though it's kind of something I experience every day. It's not at all. I mean, I have the people I work with, I all love, and they're all great. And, you know, I really enjoy my kind of research group and all my collaborators and everything. So on the whole, it's a positive working environment. It's just some things you have to bear in mind with academia and research.
Given that academia research can be really, really tough, and, you know, there's lots of these sort of knockbacks, and, you know, I'm sure we can also talk about jobs and sort of job security and that fun part. So why are you in academia? Like, is it just the love of your subject that drives you? Or are you just deeply curious? Like, why are you a scientist?
Yeah, mainly because I want a research space, and, you know, I like what I do, really. And academia is one of the main ways you can do that. I will say that I do not intend to stay in academia forever. I find it very, very competitive. And I don't know how much you know about kind of funding and all of that in academia. It's very difficult to... So, for example, my postdoc position at the moment is 2.5 years. I'm funded for until next spring, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And then sometime this year, I'm going to have to start reapplying for funding and jobs. And it's just that perpetually every few years until you either are lucky enough to get a lecture position, like a proper teaching position or a professorship eventually, or you just have to find something else. And a lot of people move into industry. So it's just a very competitive environment that I just don't want to stay in long term. And also, the higher up you go in academia, the more it just seems to be kind of admin and, you know, managing other people. And I do like 80% of my week is doing my own research. And that's not the case for all my higher ups, really. I mean, ideally, I'd like to maybe do another postdoc position or another couple of postdoc positions. And then work for a space agency. That's my like main goal, I think.
So like ESA or NASA or something like that.
Yeah, ideally, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
So last couple of questions. Thank you so mm-hmm. much for your time. Nice. So do you have any particular favorite science books or books?
Yeah. So I read. Okay, so I don't usually actually read a lot of space and science books, just because, you know,
you do it all the time.
I mean,
like maybe a pop science book, which you were.
Yeah, I don't really have favorite textbooks, but when I do read them, I like astronaut biographies. I think they're great, especially some of the ones written by the American astronauts, because, you know, they're just a bit more like, oh yeah,
gusto, do it. Yeah, like, yeah, America, yeah,
yeah. So I've read Scott Kelly's and Mike Mullane's, and I can't remember who else. I just Michael Collins. Yeah, I mean, yep. they're all great. And then basically the popular science section in Waterstones literally any book from that section is great.
Just get like, something from that shelf.
It's just, they're just, they're also like easy to read, or generally they're all easy to read. Like Packing for Mars is another one I really like. I think it's by Mary Roach. You have to fact check that
one. I will
one.
Fact check that. Probably a footnote.
It's just kind of, she does like, she's not like a astronomer, science, astronomy writer or anything. I think she does a collection of science books, but I just, that one has lots of good facts in. Just, yeah, I like the more like the popular science angle rather than the drier, you know,
less unpopular science books. Unpopular, yeah. Science. Don't sell nearly as well. Don't know why. Why isn't this selling? Are you into sci-fi or TV shows or anything like that?
Oh yeah, yeah, or, big
or
into like
Marvel or.
Oh yeah, big into that. Big into that.
Oh yeah, love all that
yeah.
Stuff. Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Marvel character from the MCU? This is probably the most controversial question I could possibly ask you on this.
Probably. Oh no.
Yeah, I have to answer that.
No, yeah. I think probably Captain America.
Captain America. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just good.
Or Loki. I do really like Loki. Like, I really like the last the Loki series. That was great.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sort of time travel, all that stuff. Different. What was it? Yeah. The Time Enforcing Authority.
The TVA.
So, TVA, there we go. Yeah, God, I'm so tired. I will edit that out. Time Enforcing Authority, TEA. What are you talking about? All right. And then last question really is what is science to you? How would you define science? What do you see it?
I think I mean it's very hard to condense, I guess, what I do into a couple of sentences of what it means to me, but I guess for me it's just learning, you know, how and why things work and how the world is the way it is, and using kind of facts and factual knowledge as well as creativity to solve problems, and then using that knowledge and the answers to expand our way of thinking and living, and, you know, going on to ask more questions and answer more questions. You know, for every question you ask in physics or science, is 10 more which lead on from that. So it's just,
Hydra.
Just, yeah. Yeah. I think that's what I like most about science is, for me, it's problem solving at its core, which I was always really into as a kid, you know, like trivia and puzzles and that kind of thing.
Lego.
Yeah. Well, I'm still into Lego. But yeah, it's, so for me, it's just problem solving and being a bit, you know, creative about it in essence. So,
do you think science discovers truth about the universe? Do you think there's like an objective truth, and not necessarily say that we found it, obviously, because physics isn't complete, but do you think we're basically, that's what we're digging up?
Yes and no. So there's kind of like the fundamental theories, which, you know, I don't believe they will be disproved, like gravity and things like that.
Hmm.
But then, I mean, it's actually something that really surprised me about coming into science professionally is the level of debate and disagreement about things. You know, in my naive younger years, I thought, you know, getting into science would be like, this is this, once it's in the textbook, it's fact, you can't disagree with it. And it's just not, it's not true at all. You know, there's always room for improvement and refining a theory and discovering something new. So, yeah.
Amazing. Dr. Charlotte Waterfall, thank you so much for your time. If people want to find you online, where should they follow you, or where can they find you?
Okay, so I think my TikTok handle is space_waterfall.
Yep.
And then my Instagram handle, which is still a very young account, is space_waterfallc.
Brilliant. I mean, I'll put both of those in the show notes. So,
okay, great.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to support the podcast, the very best thing you can do is share this episode with any friends who you think might like it. Or indeed, give us a rating on whatever app you may be using at this moment in time. I also still very much consider myself a beginner in this, so if you have any feedback or comments, please just drop me a DM and let me know what I did wrong or how I can improve. I've got some amazing episodes coming up, including a solo one dedicated as a crash course into the philosophy of science, which, if I'm lucky, might be out next week, but we'll see. In the meantime, my socials are at jack.lauro on Instagram and TikTok, and my website is jacklawrence.net. If you'd like to support me more directly, I do have a Patreon at patreon.com/jacklawrence, but please feel no obligation. Many thanks for tuning in today, and until next time.